Hi, everybody. I am so delighted to be able to podcast today with my special guest. Her name is Nicole Kahn, and I'm going to tell you what it says about her, but boy, she is so much more than this. She's a writer, she's a director, she's an editor, and she's a mother. Welcome to the show, Nicole.
Thank you so much, Marcia. I'm so happy to be with you today.
Oh, it's just going to be just great. And, you know, I like to start my podcast off by having our listeners get to know a little bit about you. So could you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I was born in Mesa, Arizona, and my family, my real father and mother traveled like to 39 different places during my childhood. And I left home very, very early and started working in the real world. And the only thing I ever wanted to do was be a writer all my life since third grade. And so I would get up at 4 a.m. to write books and scripts and everything before I'd go to work. And so my intention was always to be a novelist. But I ended up somehow deciding I was going to do small independent films as well. And that's really where my career has been focused the last 35 years.
Oh, just a short period of time, right?
Yes.
35 years.
Yes.
It's funny how what happens in our childhood affects as we grow up. You know, I think that that's not uncommon if people were to really kind of look back at their childhood and think, you know, I was always interested in this or whatever kind of resonated with them. I find that to be quite common. So you mentioned a little bit about your background, and your films have deeply resonated with audiences, with some fans watching them over 100 times. What do you think it is about your storytelling that creates such a strong emotional connection? This is amazing.
I've been so, so blessed. I cannot tell you in terms of, the riches that have been bestowed upon me as I tried to move into my film career. I had a lot of people helping me. And the biggest thing I found is that because I was writing what I call sort of adult romance, you know, there's serious issues that we're investigating. Usually it's something I'm trying to unwind and heal in my own life. And I think because it's so personal, it really hits people sort of at their core. And I think if they are wanting to be in love when they watch my movies, they're very, very romantic. And I mean that in the best sense of the word. Romance has gotten a bad reputation over the years. I personally think it's probably one of the best things we have in our life. but people love to feel the feelings of falling in love. And I think that's part of it. And so they watch the films over and over and over again. But I've also had people who have written me and I've become very connected to who have used my films to heal, where they watch the film over and over and over again because they're trying to get over the death of their mother or situations that they're living in currently in their lives where they're closeted and with a husband perhaps that they don't want to be with. And so the films speak to them about a freedom that they can't experience at the moment.
That makes sense to me. So, you know, I think this is very interesting when we describe ourselves. And when I mentioned that you are a writer, director, editor, and mother, why did you add mother on your website where you are credited as a writer, director, and editor, and mother? Why did you add mother there? That must
because
be very important to you.
Mothering is the absolute most important thing that I do. It's also the thing that I most self-identify as. First and foremost, a mother, beyond anything else. I love my kids and my stepkids with every fiber of my being, and they have informed my life as it is. I mean, I was pretty intolerable until my daughter was born, and I realized you had to take care of other people on this planet. But it was the birth of my very micro preemie son who...
Uh-oh. We're having a little bit of an echo. Can you keep speaking? Oh, technology is never fun. You're echoing, and so I'm not able to hear you right now, Nicole. I don't know if you're able to hear me. Oh, dear. This is always a problem.
Hello, Marcia. Hello.
I don't know if you can even hear me right now, Nicole.
It feels like we lost
is
connection.
The problem when technology. Nicole,
oh,
I see the
are.
back.
There you are. Can you hear me?
I can't.
I'm so sorry. I don't know where we ended up because I didn't
realize.
Well,
you were talking about. So let me help you with that, because you know what? This technology is the technology, as my dearly departed husband would say, it is what it is. It's frustrating, but we will move forward. We were talking about your children and about the fact that you have, how important it is to be a mother. I wanted to just interrupt you right there for a moment. How many children do you have?
Well, I have two kids with my first partner and four additional stepkids with my second, and a granddaughter in the mix, which is my little Ocean is her name. I always say she delights the heart and the soul. I mean, she is just phenomenal.
That's really. Did you have siblings growing up?
Yes, two brothers and two sisters. But
okay.
I have to say, when we had all six kids together, it was quite the Brady Bunch, and they were all like a year apart. So every one of them entered teen years, one after the other, and each of them became a mutant of themselves, as I call them, until they turn 18. So it was very difficult to have like four or five teenagers in the house at a time.
Well, it was probably harder on your parents than it was on you. Oh my God. Okay. So, and moving on with getting to know you, which makes me always want to break out into a song.
Yes.
You're known for casting leads with incredible on-screen chemistry. And I would like to know, what's your secret to finding and nurturing that spark between the actors?
Well, the first thing is I literally sit in the room and auditions for every single person who's reading for one of the leads. I don't care who they are, where they came from. If they're the right person, I'm casting them. And the most important thing to me is if you're telling a love story and your leads don't have chemistry, which is sort of the bane of my existence with, studio movies, which are packaged. They don't care whether they have chemistry or not. Having chemistry is the single most important thing in a love story. So if they don't have that, what's the point of doing the film? I mean, it's so hard to make a movie. Especially when you're wearing a lot of different hats and always short of money. So you want to make sure that what you're doing isn't a waste of time. And I do chemistry reads, three or four or five, six different versions with different actresses. I put them through the ringer pretty much. But that comes up with the best two people to play the two lead roles.
You know, I always find it very interesting when people are in their genre and they use terms that are so common to you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No. Oh, no, don't misunderstand me.
Oh.
This is what everybody does. That's where I come in as a podcaster. Please don't apologize. So when you talk about, did you say chemistry leads?
Chemistry reads. They're literally
reads.
Chemistry reads.
So give me an example. What is a chemistry read? What is
well,
that?
Well, it used to look very different way before the Me Too era came upon us. For my first chemistry reads, I literally had the girls take their shirts off so we could see what they looked like, how they interacted, things along those lines, in a very sensitive manner, let me tell you. But you can't do that today.
Yes.
The chemistry reads are really about them coming in and having them kiss and make sure that, there's something there. So we'll take the two A and B person for one character, A and B person for another character, and we'll chemistry read them with five, six, seven different actresses. And so it can be a little bit of grueling for the leads to have to make out with different other different women, over and over again to find the right, recipe for that, that spark that you just feel between them. And I don't allow them to become friends. I make them stay separate until we're done with the shooting of the film so that they are really in a meeting of them. And so all of that stuff stays fresh.
I see.
So they're discovering each other on the set, just like they are in the film.
I like knowing that. So I think that music plays a pretty significant role in your films. And I love music. And how do you collaborate with composers to create the perfect score that complements your visual storytelling?
I think one of the things I'm most proud of is every single score of every film I've done, I think is pretty effective. This all comes down to my being raised with a classical pianist, which is how we get to descending thirds eventually. But I'm so sorry, just a second. I just have to wave this person away so they don't come up. I'm so sorry.
Okay. It's live, honey. I get it.
Okay, I'll talk to you later. Okay, they went away.
Very good.
I didn't want my dog barking. Sorry.
That's not a problem.
I'm sorry. Where were we? That took me off what we were talking. Where were we?
We were talking about the music and the.
Yes. Okay. So.
There was a pianist in your family.
My mother was a classical pianist. Yes.
Wow.
And I grew up with classical music, which is one of the greatest gifts I've ever been given. And that helped inform the way I wanted to score things in a much more classical sense, with pieces I thought would be super emotional and moving, things along those lines. But you can talk to any composer I've worked with, and I kind of, because of my music background, I sort of sit on them until I get what I want. I think of all the people who work with me, composers have got to have it the most difficult. Because I'm very specific, I know exactly what I want, and I don't. I make them deliver that, and they end up feeling very challenged in a good way. So it ends up being okay, but at the time, the process can be a little daunting for composers.
Well, but you know, I think that what I'm understanding about what you're saying is that this is very important to you. And you have a concept of what you're looking for. And so if you can be clear on your concept, then that means that that music will deliver what you're looking for, or they're not the right person for you. So
exactly.
It seems like a perfect partnership in my mind. I think music tells a wonderful story. When we talk about some of your films, More Beautiful for Having Been Broken.
Yes.
Elena, is that how I say that?
Elena Undone, yeah.
Elena mm-hmm. Undone. And Little Man, your documentary, they were all inspired by very personal experiences. And I think that those personal experiences, hey, that's why I'm doing what I'm doing.
Yep.
So why don't you tell us about that? But I'd like to hear that story.
Well, you know, this goes to one of the adages of an agent that spoke to me one day when I had had a really big project that this agent thought was going to make huge, you know, huge, huge sales. And it nothing ended up happening with it. And so the next agent I was talking about, I said, I don't want to write what's supposed to be written. He said, write the book you want to read. And so I was like, whoa, what a concept. Okay. It also goes to make the film you want to see, in my mind. But also, I've had a number of tragedies in my life that have also informed me besides motherhood. And part of the way I was able to keep them at, you know, arm's length distance was to make film about them. This is specifically relevant to Little Man, the documentary I made about Nicholas, because he was born so early. I had actually just gotten my professional camera the day before he came, 100 days early. We were shooting a documentary about surrogacy because my son was carried by a surrogate. And the minute he was born, I didn't even care about the camera because he was on death's door for weeks and weeks and weeks. My brother shot everything inside the NICU, and there was no HIPAA laws because it was right before the HIPAA laws. So we shot footage nobody had ever seen the likes of in the NICU, because most people don't have a camera in the NICU.
Right.
And so we were able to make this story about what these little babies go through and should they be going through this. And as a mother, I'm like, I need to save my son at all costs. And so it really poses the questions I had to ask myself in the film. For instance, my ex-partner wanted to terminate the pregnancy because we didn't know what was wrong with him. And I literally could not terminate the pregnancy. You could have put a gun to my head and I couldn't do it. So it became a major issue for us, and ultimately we split over because his involvement, there's 24/7 nursing for him still 22 years later. And so we had a small hospital in our home, and I think that was very, very challenging for her and my and our daughter as well. So yes, so it is very, very personal, and More Beautiful is specifically based on my relationship with my son and my daughter. And my daughter's in the film because she was a theater brat for years, and it's her first film role. So yeah, everything becomes very personal. Elaine Undone was based on the relationship I had with my then partner, Marina Rice Bader, who's the mother of the other four kids. That was our story. So it was very, very personal. It's, I think, without that sort of pull for me, the work is so hard. I have to be totally passionate about it.
I can see that. And Nicholas is your son's name?
Yes.
And how old is he today?
He's 22 today,
And
and
his health is, he's
he's
fine?
still he's still very medically fragile. He has 24/7 nursing. He has 14 breathing treatments a day, but
Oh
he is
my
the
goodness.
happiest, most lovely human person on this planet, and everybody who meets him agrees. I'd love for you to
Wow.
see the documentary, Marsha, because you'll see who he is.
Wow, that's really amazing. My daughter wasn't that serious, but she did have issues when she was first born, and I know what that's like when your kid has issues when they're born. So I think people that are listening can relate to that if they too have experienced something like that. My heart is beating fast for you.
Oh.
You've been described as a maverick in the film industry. What challenges have you faced as an independent filmmaker, and how have you overcome them?
Again, I've been so, multiply blessed. My last four projects have been crowdsourced, meaning fans have either donated to small amounts or they come in. I do this thing where I give, I basically, it's called pay for credits. 25,000, you're an associate producer, 50,000, you're an executive producer. It's the only way that I can actually raise money because I can't tell people they're going to make money off my films because the LGBT community is still too niched to actually make money unless you have main stars. And so that's sort of the biggest sort of challenges that I've experienced where people just say you can't do that because it's just not done, or if you have to have a lot more money to do it. I think one of my greatest strengths is putting money on the screen. I can make a film look much, much more expensive than it is because I've learned those tricks, and then that's also I think one of the reasons my films continue to live on. Claire of the Moon has a had a 10th year anniversary release, a 20th, and we're just about to do a 35 year anniversary re-release for Claire of the Moon. That's how long I've been around. And Elaine Undone, again, 10th anniversary re-release. So these films keep living within the community. And also, I have a lot of straight fans as well, who really enjoy the romance and the adult relationships. It's not everything is. It's not serious. There's a lot of comedy inside some of the situations inherently. But it's like adult romance that you'd never see anymore.
That's interesting. I'm trying to put myself in your shoes and trying to imagine what it was like doing what you've been doing all these years, and it's really quite remarkable. And your fans have said that your films have helped them heal.
Yes.
There's been a lot of issues in your community. Can you give us some examples about how these films have actually helped your fans?
Yeah, like I have two of my favorite, well, I have three favorite stories.
Sure,
One
share.
is one is one is just from a sheer human interest. This gentleman who's like 77, he's run a projection in the same cinema in the UK for like 56 years. And when he sees A Perfect Ending, my film, it's his number one favorite film of his life. This is a projectionist. Who's seen every movie on the planet, right? Straight man, he introduced all of his kids to the film. You know, we maintained communication. He would send gifts to my kids for Christmas. It's just, you know, he was so thrilled that a film that many years later became his favorite film after seeing every movie on the planet. And, you know, it really, really fed me. And the biggest, hugest story that I have, though, is a woman saw a perfect ending and she contacted me. And she had been married to a man who was abusive and had Asperger's. Mm. And she was a lesbian and she knew she was a lesbian, but decided she was evil because they were very, very involved in the, you know, in a major, major church where none of that is even allowed. They're not even allowed to play cards. So she lived in this solitary 40 years of life with this man, saw my film, contacted me. About a year and a half later, he died suddenly of, you know, from a heart attack. And he had left her all this money. And she funded Coming Out for Love almost entirely herself because of what A Perfect Ending did for her. So it's like she then came down to the set of Coming Out for Love and sat around all these young lesbians who were, you know, it's like The Bachelor, but in Lesbianville. And she had the time of her life. And she went back home and she came out to everybody. So it's like that's pretty profound, you know, from a viewer who's watched one of my films.
It's almost like she got permission, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, things are different today than they were when I was growing up in the gay and lesbian community. I think that, you know, there will always be people that won't be accepting. But I'd like to think that we've come a long way in recognizing that people are who people are.
Yep.
And we are not in a position to judge how someone else wants to live their life and who they want to love.
Hear, hear.
And I'm a firm believer in that. I think we've come a long way from when I was in school and the slang words that we used when we were talking about gay men, mostly men. We see this.
No, women didn't exist.
Men were.
Right.
Isn't that funny? And you know, it's, I don't mean to just trigger off for a moment, but man, when I was growing up, I'm a lot older than you. When I was growing up, the word queer was like using the F word.
Yep.
That was a terrible word to use. Yep. And now it is a very accepted used word to use, isn't it?
Well, it's one of the most accepted versions because the youth, this is one thing I learned on the set of Coming Out for Love, because the contestants were in their mid-20s. They have a whole different vocabulary than we did when we were coming out. It's just a totally different universe. So, you know, it's very much changed.
It is really very interesting. So let's talk a little bit about your book, Descending Thirds. And I guess I should say, I'm never quite sure, so you tell me, do I call it a book or do I call it a novel?
Well, it's both. You know, it's a novel because it's fiction and it's a book because it's a book.
Okay.
It's, you know, a book I wrote 25 years ago.
Wow.
I always, this is a very, very personal project to me because it has to do with the three people I love the most in the world, my mother, my son, and my daughter. My mother was a classical pianist. The story goes, when she had me, we were on the Indian reservation in Mesa, Arizona, so she had to go out of the reservation. She had me, but when she got home, my father had bought her a piano. And so she looked at me, tossed me in the crib, and played piano until I started crying for food. And so it's sort of like, I feel like from that moment on, it sort of was absorbed in my DNA. As a kid, once she had a grand piano as a kid, I would always lay under the piano and listen to her play, which I wrote into the book. But she is the absolute reason that I, you know, fell in love with classical music. Fast forward, you know, to my daughter being gestated. I had the most creative time during my daughter's gestation and birth. After she was born, I was in the midst of all of the revisions, and I would wear her in my Bjorn and write all day long with her just like slapped to me. And it was really, really lovely. And then when my I'm so sorry.
That's okay. What's your dog's name?
Ladybugs. Like, okay. You know, Duchess. She's Lady. Ladybug. And when Nicholas finally came home from the hospital, the thing he loved most in the world was Baby Einstein and all the classical music. We had to buy him one CD after another, that's all he would listen to. And today still, that's one of his great loves. And so it's sort of a family thing. And then the final bit of this is that my mother has a serious, severe aggressive Parkinson's. And every day she tries to play the piano. And for the last 4 years, it's been so heartbreaking for me to listen to her, to watch her, to see her try to do what she's done, you know, effortlessly all of her life, you know, and sit there and tells me, I don't understand, the black keys are 2 inches above the white keys and I can't feel my fingers. And, you know, it's just horrible. But we're doing the audiobook and we're laying pieces of music. Every time I reference a piece of music, we're laying it in the background. And I get to use 4 of my mom's pieces in the audiobook. So I really feel great about that. Yeah.
So help me if I didn't pay attention here. So what inspired you to go from venturing from the literature to writing how does it differ from writing a film?
Well, this probably isn't really PC, but I always say writing a book is like smoking weed. It's very labyrinthian and it's just very intense and mysterious and all those sorts of things. And making a film is like taking acid. It's like creating a reality, you know, it's a whole different set of skills that you use and everything else. It's a whole different medium. And I
go ahead.
Oh, I love them both. I love them both so much. I've been so, again, blessed to be able to do what I'm the most passionate about, which is to create stories, whatever format they should be in, you know, like Coming Out for Love is a great snapshot of our community as a lesbian bachelorette, you know, 16 one-hour episodes. It's like, it's just been very, very, I've been very, very blessed with people helping me from the very beginning. Pam Curry, one of the executive producers on Claire of the Moon, taught me everything on the set. You know, I'm a total autodidact. I've never gone to school for anything.
Isn't that interesting? So you really do have quite a personal backstory on Descending Thirds, don't you?
Oh, yeah. It's the most personal of all my pieces because of that, besides Little Man, obviously, since it was our lives. And, speaking of healing, that film has healed so many people who have gone through the same experience. Probably more people have been healed by Little Man than anything.
Isn't that great? You hear from your fans, don't you?
Oh, yes. I've been very, very lucky. Very lucky.
That's nice. Do you write every day?
I'm writing something pretty much every day because I'm creating one thing or another, you know. So, yeah, pretty much.
I think about, you know, I'm trying to put myself in your brain for a moment, and I'm thinking, gosh, how do you ever turn that off? Is it always going? Do you always get
it's
an
always
idea?
Going because I always have. It's always going because I always have 3 or 4 projects that are in some stage of development, post production, in production, you name it. So I do stay very, very engaged with that. But I've also learned through COVID, I think probably helped me the most, to take a chill pill and, you know, be a little bit more mindful, be a little bit more present. And when I turned 65, I gave myself the gift because I work every day. At 2 o'clock, I can quit and I can do whatever I want after that.
Right.
You know?
Right. So, this is when you kind of put your hands on your hips and you say, you're not the boss of me. You
know, exactly.
I get to do what I want, right?
Right.
I get that. Truly, I do. I got a decade on you. So your work often focuses on romance, as you've been saying. What do you believe are the key ingredients for a compelling love story, regardless of the character's orientation?
I really think, more than anything, it is paying attention to all the details that make up romance. You know, it's not just the big lustful moment of kissing. It's the way you look at each other, the, you know, the swallow, the, you know, the glance aside, the double take, all of those things that build something. And there's been people who have said, oh, would they get to it already? You know, and it's like, why are we in such a rush? Enjoy the trip, enjoy the journey of romance. And I think part of why it becomes so romantic is because I deal with it seriously. Like I said, whether it's the score being a serious score for a film, or the cinematography, I'm very, you know, visual is everything as well. I've been blessed to work with some really good DPs, directors of photography, cinematographers. And it's all of it, you know, again, paying attention to all the little things. That's what I think romance is anyway. You know, when your partner says, oh my God, I like that, but I want it in green. And you remember that and get it for her for Christmas in green.
Yeah. I'm trying to imagine what this is like to be so creative, and I can't imagine that you ever really turn it off. It's impossible, right?
No. And you know what I have discovered? It's like, the more I lean into it, the more it gives me back. Like, for instance, I decided I was going to do all the special effects for this thing I have called Blue Love Dance, A Scent of Romance. It'll be coming out in a few months. I decided I was going to learn every special effect on that. And it gave me so much joy. Yes, like you, Marcia, I was like, technology, it's making me crazy. I don't understand this. To finally, you know, getting it to work the way you want it to work and feeling just like that burst of, you know, excitement that it actually happened. And yes, it took you 20 hours to figure out how to do that dissolve, but hey.
Right. You did it.
Yeah.
You took a few yoga breaths, did you?
Yeah, exactly. I was sort of like where you were in the beginning of our conversation today.
I know, you know, it's like, oh my God, where did she go? Yeah. Oh, she's back. Oh, I know, you
that
know.
That was so good, though, that it was your own volume.
Well, you know, it's funny. This is not brain surgery, and I understand that. But where you and I are very similar is we have a passion for what we do.
Yes.
And we take what we do seriously. And we don't want to get a C on our report card.
You're right.
Right? We want to get an A on it. We want to give our best. We want to give it our best, whatever that best looks like. Yep. My best may be different than Susie's best. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't really matter. It's not a competition. What's important is, have I given my best? And if I can close my eyes at night and say, you know, you did your very best, whatever that might be, whatever that
exactly.
might be.
Exactly.
Regardless.
I'll tell you, though, there is one best that I always have a struggle with.
What's that?
There are many times there is one best that I always have a struggle with, which is, what is the best thing for the film? What is the best thing for the book? Not what you like here, not this little flight of fancy that you're having here, but what's best for the film or the book? And that has kept me honest. I make myself, no matter how much I might not like it, I have to do what's right for the project, what's best for the project.
Right. I understand that. You should see, if you were sitting in my office right now, you would see post-it notes all over the place. Once she stopped rushing through life, she was amazed how much life she has time for. That was from my yoga instructor. It's sitting right in front of me.
Good for you.
Another one, manage your expectations.
Yep.
You know, these are things, how about stop, breathe, and rethink? You know, these are things that, be impeccable with your word.
Yep.
Don't make assumptions. Mm-hmm. Always do your best. These things are in my office, along with the pictures of my husband, bless his soul, and my kids, because I live alone. You know, my husband yep. wasn't supposed to leave almost 16 years ago next month. I was, you know, he was here and then he wasn't. And so I had to pivot, as they say,
yep.
and I didn't do it instantly, obviously, but, you know, he lived by a simple slogan, and people hear me say this all the time, and I'm sorry to make this about me, but it seems like this is the perfect place to add this. He would always say to me, Nicole, it is what it is.
Yep.
And I would always put a comma after that and say, yeah, but. And then he would say, no, it is what it is, period. Adapt. Mm-hmm. Now, this is an engineer. Hello. This is not my personality. I tell people he was the rock. I was the mouthpiece.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was his mindset. That was why he was a successful engineer. But I, that's why we compliment, you know, if you have the identical personality to your partner, you're going to always be in a competition, I think. But if don't you think so? If you bring, if you each bring your own skill set together, I'm sorry to make this about me right now, but we have plenty of time to have this conversation. So I felt it was important to add this because of what we're talking about relationships. It doesn't matter if it's who's with who. What the matter is the relationship working?
Right.
Are you both happy? Are you both meeting each other's needs? Those things are very important. And paying attention to details, as you mentioned. So when you are primarily a filmmaker, but you started out as a novelist with this 3-book deal with Simon Schuster.
Yeah. Back in the day when I thought, oh, wow, that was easy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because it was like, the first book I wrote, my agent got a deal, and then they wanted my next book, so they made a 3-book deal. So it was like, and I got an advance back in the day, you know? Today, it's a whole different world.
Really?
So yes. And
did you happen to transition into creating Coming Out for Love, which I want you to talk about that. This is the first ever LGBTQ dating competition show, kind of like The Bachelor Nation, right?
Yep. Yes.
Let's talk about that.
Okay. Well, I was watching The Bachelor because I'm a romantic with my daughter, Gabrielle, and she started watching it with me when she was like 6 or 7. She just loved it. She loved, like, we would pick our horse and bet on her and hope she was going to, you know, get him at the end. And about 2 or 3 years into that, she turned to me. She said, Mommy, I don't understand. Why isn't there one like you and Mommy Gwen? You know, why aren't there women dating women? And in that very moment, I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to do a lesbian coming bachelorette. 15 years it took me to do it. I was determined. And then when the funding came through, as I said, through, I can say her name, Joanne Millar, who's one of my greatest supporters. She basically funded it, and we shot it in 21 and released it in 23. And it's 16 1-hour episodes, and it's Coming Out for Love, and it's a key master. So she gives people the key to try to help her find her heart instead of a rose kind of thing. But it shows we have 16 really amazing young women as contestants and 19 guest spot judges, people that were coming in to do some of the, you know, competitions that they were doing. All amazing. It makes our community look so damn good, I have to say. I'm so proud of the show, and I'm so proud of our community. I haven't been able to sell it, though, yet. And I think that is because people just don't know what the heck to think.
Yeah. If somebody wanted to see this, where would they find it?
Comingoutforlove.com, NicoleKahnFilmsGlobal.com. All of my stuff is on both of those sites.
Okay.
And it's a brand new site with new perks, more perks, less money, all kinds of grooviness. Please go to NicoleKahnFilmsGlobal.com and ComingOutForLove.com.
Interesting. So this is a paid subscription, I'm presuming.
Yes.
Got you.
But with the subscriptions of both the levels in Nicole Kahn Films Global, they get to see the entire season.
Got it. Okay, good to know. So you had mentioned before about your first film, Claire of the Moon.
Yes.
It became a cult classic.
Yep.
With let's talk about this. We have ample time to understand this. So,
okay.
You're often cited as being one of the first to create an ancillary for an LGBTQ film for COT. What's the COTM? What does that stand for?
Oh, Claire of the Moon. That's its acronym.
Claire of the Moon. I'm so sorry.
So no worries.
So let's talk about this. We've got time for that.
So we're making this movie, and there's a couple of lesbians who came with cameras, And so we decided we were going to do a making of, which is Moments, the making of Claire of the Moon. And the funny thing is, way, way back when, Claire of the Moon was a film in 35 millimeter. We had 12 prints, so we could only play in certain cities, right? So people that had theaters where women would come to see the film, they would see Moments in the popcorn, in the popcorn tray, and they would take Moments home, which was on VHS, and they would watch the making of the film before the film actually got to them. And doing that, the film lived for 18 months on the circuit, and I traveled all over with it, festivals, you name it. It was picked as one of Sundance Channel's first 10 movies that they put up. We were, you know, at really like Toronto Film Festival, Boston Film Festival. We were really, it was really well received in the straight community. And it's gone on to live through many re-releases. But the thing that happened was these women shot all this film. So I put together the Moments, the making of, and showed how we put this film together. And then we did a soundtrack because I really wanted a soundtrack because of the score being so important to me.
Cancellation. There you are.
Oh, sorry. I was just going on to, we made the Moments, the making of, which was essentially how we made this, put this movie together. And then the score, because it was so beautiful, we did a cassette, and back in the day, you know, this cassette and CDs back in those days, there were film shots like that were 8x8, you know, 12x18s and stuff along those lines. We ended up having t-shirts, sweatshirts. We even ended up having a Christmas ornament with Claire of the Moon film strips connected to bells. It was a cottage industry for 7 years. It just never ended. And I think it's because it was literally the only thing out since Desert Hearts, and that was 7 years prior. But that was set in a time period, and Claire of the Moon was set in the present, so the dialogue could be had. Why are you with women? You know, so it was a whole different kind of thing.
Right.
And it just lived and lived and lived. And I have college students who contact me and tell me how much they love the film. I think it's my worst film in terms of technically how it's made, but I think it's very successful in terms of the love story. So
that's nice. It's always nice to get feedback, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
I think it's important. I do. Do you ever speak at universities?
I used to speak all the time with Little Man.
I bet.
I traveled everywhere with that. Yeah.
Yeah. Because you're still currently in Arizona, correct?
Oh, no. I'm in Los Angeles, and
that's right. I knew that. You grew up in Mesa, Arizona, but you live here now. That's right. So with Elena Undone.
Yeah.
Okay, I kind of like this because as you're listening, my listener friends, you might imagine that some of these questions come to me because my guest has provided me with some of these questions. So I obviously haven't seen these films, obviously, because you can tell by my questions.
Yep.
So in Elena Undone, it has the longest kiss in cinema history.
It does indeed.
How did that come about?
Okay. So I was with my then partner, Marina Rice-Bader, and we were talking about, you know, the way we fell in love was so dramatic. It made a good film. But the piece we were talking about was, how do you actually convey that first kiss you have with somebody that is so intense and so romantic and so, like, you know, you feel like you've lost consciousness.
Right.
And with Marina, I have to say, she was a wonderful kisser. And we kissed the first time we kissed for 8 hours. And I wanted to make that visually. And so we decided, I looked it up, and it was I looked up who had the longest cinema kiss before that. And it was like a 1947 film or something where they were glued to each other. That's why they have the longest kiss, because they were glued to each other.
That's literally glued. Is that right?
Yes. So I was like, okay, that doesn't count, but we have to beat the amount. And they were at 3 minutes and 7 seconds. And I think we're at 3 minutes and 39 seconds. But what we did was we used Steadicams and went around and around. And when I edited it, I tried to tell as much of a story, playing it out as one. We had to play it out essentially as one long thing, because you cannot break Kiss or you don't make that record. So we did four takes. The poor Steadyman guy, I think, was about to lose his mind because it was so hard. It was a long, long take. And their third take was magical. And so we used that and then worked on a really cool rockin' song to go underneath it. It just became a huge thing. And I was very proud to have that be the longest Kiss in cinema history. It belonged to a lesbian film.
So did you, maybe you said this and I went over my head and didn't pay attention. Did you study film in college?
No, I used to watch black and white movies from the time I was in third grade. Okay. I was a book and movie head, and I would wake up and watch the late show. Remember that back in the day? And I'd watch all these Clark Gable movies because I was madly in love with Clark Gable, not realizing I was gay at that time. And watched everything he made, and then watched everything all of his co-stars made. And I think that set me up for the sort of romance part of the filmmaking. So yeah, I don't remember where we were going, but anyway.
You know, what I was curious to know is, a lot of people study filmmaking in college. Oh, yeah. I was just wondering for you what that was like.
No, I decided, I mean, I just am, I'm not, I was a straight A student. Right. I learned fast and I've been blessed with some smarts. And so I just decided to teach myself. And so that's what I did. And I had people, like I said, help me along the way. You know, like my first DP cinematographer, Randy Sellers, he taught me all about the lenses, what to use, when. And then pretty soon at the end of the thing, he says, like, oh, God, you're better at this than me. So,
I mean, I think you're glossing over that, in that that's really remarkable. When I'm three blocks away from Loyola Marymount University.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Where people study filmmaking and pay thousands and thousands of dollars to do so.
Yes, they
and
do.
And I think it's really interesting how you came into this world and were able to be so able to be self-taught by experts and could absorb it all. I think that's just remarkable.
Well, thank you. I've been, like I said, very, very blessed and grateful. My stepfather taught me at a very young age, reading was pretty much the most important thing you could do. And I read nonstop. I mean, everybody, whenever they saw me, I had a book in my hand. So, you know, I learned a lot from that. And that's why people think I have a college education, but I don't. I just learned a lot from reading and teaching myself stuff.
Well, I think that's remarkable. I think you're humble. I don't hear anything about you breaking your hand, slapping yourself on the back. I think that you're very humble, and that the fact that you were able to teach yourself all of this and be so successful, not only in filmmaking, but in writing and everything, I just think it's great. And so, you know, there's all kinds of great shows out there. I'm a TV person. When you were growing up with a book, I was growing up with the TV and American Bandstand. So this is just kind of for fun. If you were stuck on a desert island, what would be the one TV series you'd watch until the end of the film? Until the end of time. Until the end of time. If you could just watch one TV show, what would you continue to watch?
Well, my number one favorite series ever was the reboot of Battlestar Galactica in 2004. I think it's one of the smartest shows ever. It was basically really dealt with AI in a full way, way before we were talking about AI, and so well cast and such great storylines. Like, what would you do in this circumstance if, you know, you're with the last of humanity kind of thing? So that would definitely be one. And close second, Gilmore Girls, because that's one of my daughters and my favorite.
Right. It's interesting. I am a TV.
What about you? What would you take?
Well, you know, I tend to like, I don't watch too many movies on TV personally. I tend to like to sit on the side of the TV that has game shows or
Oh.
musical competitions like The Voice or
Oh,
America's
okay,
Got
gotcha, gotcha.
Talent or The Masked Singer, Jeopardy. I like to watch. Plus, I'm also a sports fanatic. So if my Clippers are playing, I'm watching basketball.
Gotcha,
So
gotcha.
I really do that. And and I'm also a Sparks season ticket holder.
That's
And
right. And I used to be too.
yes, and my husband and I started out as original Sparks ticket
I
holders.
know, so did
Some,
we. That's what you said. I was
yes.
saying we were probably at the
Yep.
stadium at the same time.
28 years ago. That's
Yep.
absolutely true. So it's interesting how connections happen
Yep.
because that's really because of all of we're the heterosexual couple amongst all of our lesbian friends. And
I
that's truly how this whole thing started with me when one of my friends said, you ought to think about doing something like this. And
Yeah.
thanks to my friend, I was able to move forward, and Deb Blaine was the reason that I was able to do what I'm doing today, and I'm so very grateful.
That's so great.
Yeah, so if there's something that's we've had a little bit of time left, and I'm sorry if I keep diverting off to my own life, but if somebody was thinking about something that maybe they could ask themselves, what would you say is the most fascinating thing about you that no one would ever, never know?
Well,
Okay, here comes the secret.
I don't know if it's fascinating.
Well,
It's more, I shouldn't have probably used the word fascinating. But no, I kind of am ruled by the four P's right now, which is like parenting, my
yes.
puppydom with my little girl. And I am a freakishly obsessive puzzler. I'd puzzle 3, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 pieces. I love
Wait, let me
puzzling.
interrupt you right there. Are you talking jigsaw puzzle?
Yes.
Okay, so now why am I making this about me again? So besides watching TV at night, I've got my iPad in front of me,
Oh, are you
and
doing
I'm
puzzles on the
jigsaw
iPad?
puzzle all night on my iPad.
Yeah. I have to be they have to be real puzzle pieces in my
Yep.
hand. I literally have a 4 by 10 puzzle table in one of my rooms because I'm doing when you're doing 4 or 5,000, 6,000 piece puzzles, they get huge. And so yeah, I puzzle, and I'm a fiendishly obsessed poker player as well.
Really?
Yep,
Any
love
particular
poker.
poker?
Yeah, hold'em, Texas hold'em.
Texas Hold'em.
Yep, my
That's so
favorite thing.
funny.
Yeah.
I have to take you back to the puzzle thing for a moment. So my husband was from Michigan, from the Detroit area,
Yeah.
and he still has, my nieces and niece and nephews, and they're still in Michigan. And my nephew, his wife Jennifer, always has a puzzle going on, always. And a few years ago, they were out at Christmas time, and we were putting a puzzle together. It was Christmas time, and I'm a bird brain, so I like birds. I feed the birds, I feed the ducks. I'm just that person. And we put this beautiful puzzle together, and you know what we did with it? We laminated it and framed it, and it is hanging in my kitchen.
Okay.
Have you ever have well, your
Yes,
puzzle
I
looks
have
like.
the puzzle that you see in More Beautiful for having been broken, because one of the characters is a puzzle designer. And I called Ravensburger, which is a huge puzzling manufacturer, and found the designer. And he lived in Australia. The star from More Beautiful is from Australia, and he gave me the puzzles to use for free. I could use whatever I wanted. So
That's
there's this
great.
5,000 piece puzzle that's a part of the film. And then my daughter got me that puzzle after the film was over, and it's all laminated and it takes up a huge space in my living
I
room.
would imagine. How
Yes.
long did it take to put a 5,000 piece puzzle together?
Well, if I'm going at it, probably 2 to 3 weeks. But I puzzle really fast because I puzzle all the time.
Do you have a process? Do you sort things by colors?
I used to do the, you know, all the edges first, but then
Sure.
as I went along, I was like, I don't need to do that. I can just start here. So now I do it. I do them that way. I just start where I start putting them together. Yes, you know, I don't organize them on a different board. I organize them on the board that I'm doing. That's why I got such a big board.
I see. So you always have a puzzle going, do you?
I get up at between 3 and 4, and I puzzle the first hour and a half of my life with my coffee, and then I jump into my emails and stuff.
Oh God, you're just as bad as me. So you're up in the middle of the night too, aren't you?
Yeah.
But then,
Yes.
okay, so please just tell me then, do you start, what time, if you're up at 3 o'clock in the morning, what time is lights out for you at night?
Oh, I'm done at 5. I mean, no, everybody knows, don't even ask me to do anything after 5.
But I mean, you've had dinner, right?
No. Oh, yeah, I usually go to, you know, 7 or 8, you know.
So because of the line of work you've always been in, and the fact that probably you work with people that are on the East Coast as well as the West Coast.
No, this literally, it's not that
Really?
strategic. Last year, when I was teaching myself all of the special effects for this piece I'm doing, I would wake up at 2, and I literally could not wait to get back to learning what I was doing. So I started this really weird cycle. Nobody was up. I got so much done from like 2 to 12 that that's what became my work day. And then I've been trying to move myself back ever since.
That's really interesting, you know, because that means that your evenings stop very early then, if you're
Oh,
getting
yeah.
up that early in the morning.
Yeah, like if I'm going to go out to dinner, I have to plan for it.
So you're really going out for lunch. Well,
Yeah.
what you're having
Yeah.
dinner is lunchtime, right?
Well, as I say to my stepdaughter who's living with me right now, I'm like, my work day is done when you're getting up.
Right. Isn't that funny? Isn't it interesting how we all have those cycles of how we live, you know?
Well, mine is
And
pretty much ruled by when I'm creative. Whatever my creative drive is telling me to do, it was just, you got to get up at 2 and work till 12, and that's where I feel good, you know? The rest of the day suffers, but I was able to, you know. It's like what you were saying. You love what you do. I love what I do. I can't do it enough, you know?
right. Do you get in front of the computer that early?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, when I was
Interesting.
editing, that's all it is in front of the computer.
Do you have anything really exciting that you're working on right now that you can tell us about, or do you
Yes,
have to keep that a secret?
well, I really, really want to urge everybody to read Descending Thirds because it is literally the best thing I think I've ever done. And people who've read my body of work or seen everything all agree that is my best piece. It's really important to me, obviously, from the personal thing, but I also think it really touches on something, not just for artists, but for artists in particular. It's sort of the art versus commerce. How much do I compromise to sell my script, all that kind of stuff, to the, if you're offered the opportunity to become really, really famous, what the hell are you willing to do that? You know, how far will you go off your morality? what are you willing to do? You know what I'm saying? And that's what this book really explores. With three different characters, you know, one who they're all classical pianists and the brothers are composers. One is a savant who could care less about anything business. He doesn't care about making money. He just plays his music and writes his music. Alexandra, who's based on my mother and me, we're both are very, very involved emotionally and not so strong technically. That's another character. And then the final character, Sebastian, is somebody who is willing to sell his soul and be packaged. And, you know, it doesn't, there's no level to which he will not, you know, stoop.
That's
So.
interesting. Do you see Descending Thirds ultimately being another a film?
No, its best format would be a 9-part mini series, limited mini series. Huge Emmy-winning roles, incredible opportunities for composers to create their own scores because these two
Lovely.
men are composers. Set design because it takes place between 1944 and 1975, and it really is about my love of classical music, but it's an incredible triangular love story, And as I always say, with two twist reveals you never see coming. So I would urge people who like to read to read the book. And I'm also working, though, on Blue Love Dance, which is the making of my favorite sequence in my 35-year career, which is the love scene in More Beautiful, because it's intercut with dance and nature, and it's one of the film favorites. So, I'm working on that as well.
Well, I want to thank you. I know we've had a couple of hiccups with the technology, but
no problemo.
I would say it is what it is.
Yep.
Thank you so much for joining me today and sharing your personal story with our listeners. I'm so very appreciative for your time today.
And I'm so very grateful to you, Marcia. Thank you. I really, really enjoyed this.
Me too. It was a great conversation. We will have to meet because we don't live far from one another.
Yes, we shall do that.
We shall do that because going out to eat is something. Well, of course, we'd have to make it early because you go to bed early.
Yeah.
But we'll figure that out, right? Okay, everybody. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. I look forward to sharing this all with you very soon. And thank you once again for joining me. Bye for now, everybody.